We are going to start tonight talking about hopefully some repeating and hopefully some different aspects of shame, getting us ready for Passover. 2 Kings chapter 23, Josiah was a king, one of the it had been 40 years since they had any real life in Israel. Everything had reverted to self-seeking. And Josiah was named king of Israel when he was 8 years old. And when he was 38 years old, a new thing happened. He found the book of the law. And the book of the law was read before Josiah, and it caused him so much pain that he rent his clothes and wept for the thing that he saw. There was no attempt on his part to say, well, it wasn't our fault. He saw the law. He was confronted with the law. He knew it was spiritual. He said, oh my God in heaven, where are we? And he rent his clothes and wept before the altar. Now, let's go to, and that's all that happens in chapter 22. Now in chapter 23. And the king sent, and they gathered unto him all the elders of Judah and of Jerusalem. And the king went into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him. And the priests and the prophets, and all the people, both small and great. And he took, and he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant, which was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord, to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all their heart and their soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in the book. And all the people stood to the covenant. And now he's about to begin a process where he's going through the land of Judah, specifically Jerusalem, and destroying all evidence, all high places, all evidence of idolatry. All of the places that make you internally, it's the seven mountains upon which the Whore of Babylon sits. It's the seven high places within your mind. It's the seat of the emotional impact. It's the seat of the images, the way you think things should be. It's the pillar. It's the sexual activities. It's the sexual kink. It's the thing that you think will give you life. It's all of these activities that are in the high place. And Josiah and the priests are now about to clean house in that which is a picture of our minds. Okay? And the king commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priest of the second order, and the keepers of the door, to bring forth out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels that were made for Baal and for the grove, and for the host of heaven, and he burned them without Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron, and carried the ashes of them unto Bethel. Now, Baal is not a god. Baal is not in himself a god. Baal is just whatever you think is important. You understand that? There are many, many Baalim, B-A-A-L-I-M. I-M, when you see I-M on the back of a word in the English transliteration of the Hebrew, it means it's the plural. Baalim are a whole bunch of gods, a whole bunch of them that you've put the name, your imprimatur of importance on. It doesn't matter what they are. Do you understand anything for which you have an opinion about, except the abandonment of self, is an enemy of faith? Anything for which you have an opinion about or respond emotionally to is an enemy of faith. Understand that? Okay. And he put down the idolatrous priests. Who are some of these idolatrous priests? How did he put them down? How do we put them down? You think Harry's one of the idolatrous priests?
We could have never been here.
Idolatrous priests. Remember, under the law, there's a tract of the Talmud called Abu Dazara. And it's all about, it's a huge, thick tract of the Talmud. And it's all about, Avodah Zarah means strange worship in Hebrew. And it's all about idolatrous priests and the things that you give importance to and how they are taken care of under the law. And fundamentally, that's why a synagogue or a church has to be a place where you produce your cause. You can't sit there like a dummy. You have to say what you believe so that whatever it is that you think can be brought to the surface and can be marred. You understand that?
Yeah.
Because by the law, and it's the way it works spiritually, once that Israel saw that the idol was marred, and you remember, an idol is just the way you think things should be. Yeah. Once that idol was marred, then it failed by its own nature. You don't have to worry about it anymore. It's only when you think the idol has importance that it can't fail because you are pumping it up. You are giving it life because it's you're carrying it about on your shoulders. Do you understand? It has no life except that which you give it. And it's an enemy of abandonment. God said the first requirement of a disciple is to abandon yourself, pick up your cross and follow him. Take no thought for your life. So here we are. We're getting ready for Passover. The main thing in getting ready for Passover is the destruction of idolatrous worship. And that's what we're about. Okay? So you put down the idolatrous priests by marring the idol that they represent.
Okay. There's a time not too long ago, this would have been, to me, terrible and odious and horrible. And I'm really looking
forward. So now and you're about to find out it still is.
It may be. Right now I'm looking for it.
And he brought out... No, and he put down the idolatrous priests whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah. Now that's the kings of Judah had ordained them to burn incense. To burn incense is to pray. You understand that your language is your prayers, your thoughts are your prayers. You've been taught since childhood to burn incense to an idolatrous God. Many of them. You understand that? What you give importance to. What you give importance to is what you worship. To worship means to give breath, literally, to give breath to. It can't live without your breath. You are as a God, and just as the God of the universe breathed and gave Adam breath, he breathed on him and gave him life, so you, as your own little gods, breathe on these idols and give them life. It's so critical that you understand that's what worship is. What are you worshiping? Most of you are worshiping yourself. If you're not worshiping yourself, you're worshiping your family. If you're not worshiping your family, you're worshiping your kids. If you're not worshiping your kids, you're worshiping your career. If you're not worshiping your career, you're worshiping some program or agenda or an idea that you have. We must not have agendas or ideas or programs here. We must abandon it. And that's it. We must abandon it to get ready for Passover. And even to the extent of saying that I no longer worship my children, I no longer worship my family, I no longer worship my spouse. I mean, it's big. I no longer, because what you're doing, you're gaining life from the wrong place. And it's going to fail you. It's going to shame you. And we'll find that's what we're going to talk about.
All right. Well, if we abandon programs, how do we turn around and start Alcoholics Anonymous? That's another program.
Because we have to. We just respond to a need.
It's not for us. It's for people who...
The need is... It's a childish thing, but we have a lot of children.
I still understand.
The only reason that we're giving the name of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous to these particular meeting times, and we have to set the meetings, is a lot of the people that are here as a condition of probation or parole have to go to a NA or AA meeting.
Okay.
Now, in order for us, in order for them to be able to go to these meetings that are held here, we have to have that registered as a AA/NA meeting place with the court. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't, you know, we, but that's the only way we can do it under the law.
Okay.
So there's no other, I'm not worshiping NA or AA, but because of the conditions of parole or probation, we have to set it up in that manner. Understand?
Yeah.
Okay, and he brought out the grove. Well, and he put down the idolatrous priest, whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places in the city of Judah, and in the places round about Jerusalem, them also that burned incense unto Baal, to the sun and to the moon and to the planets, and to all the host of heaven. And he brought out the grove. Now the grove isn't like a grove of trees. The word grove there is the Hebrew word Ashtaroth. And it's the female deity. It's the counterpart to Baal. It's the counterpart to the male deity. And it's the aspect of sex. Your subconscious mind sees separation as death. And that has to do something to gain life. So it sees sex as life. But not sex necessarily as just the act of intercourse. It's the whole act of however you as a child, when you were a very young child, saw what was necessary to get back to having some appearance of union. And that's what the grove represents. All right? And he brought out the grove from the house of the Lord, without outside of Jerusalem, into the brook Kidron, and burned it at the brook Kidron, and stamped it small to powder, and cast the powder thereof upon the graves of the children of the people. That's what we have to do, somehow, so that it no longer has the power over us. Now, the reason it was stamped onto the graves of the children is because all of Israel was made up of ancestor worship. And so, as a part of each of these high place activities, there was a graveyard in the high place where they buried their ancestors. Now, you have that same graveyard on your high places. It's an act of ancestor worship in each of these subconscious high places. And the ashes of that idol have to be thrown on the grave, and that declares them null. It's the legal under the law. It's the way of obviating or negating the tie to ancestor worship. And he broke down the houses of the Sodomites that were by the house of the Lord, where women wove hangings for the grove. And again, we could spend days and hours and months on each one of these scriptures, but if talk to me about them if you don't understand it. And he brought all the priests out of the cities of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense, from Geba to Beersheba, and break down the high places of the gates that were entering in of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which were on a man's left hand at the gate of the city. Nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they did eat of the unleavened bread among their brethren. And he defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the children of Hinnom, that no man might make his son or his daughter to pass through the fire to Molech. The best example of passing through the fire that you can understand is when you tell your child to finish the green beans that you, no, let me put it another way, that he can't have the dessert until he finishes the green beans. What you've done is you've invested a reward system into, that's bad for the child and caused him to desire the sugar and to hate that which is good for him. Now, the other example of passing the kid through the high places and through the fires of Molech is when you take a child and you take, he likes to say the child is at a party. And the child had a terrible time, he was embarrassed, he hated it. And you tell the child, all right, tell Johnny you had a good time. And you sit there and insist that the kid lie to save your face. Now, those are two innocent ways, but they're very obvious. Now think of the infinite number of ways that you have been passed through the fires of Molech to get to how old you are today. The value systems that you have adopted from your parents and from their parents' parents that are as meaningless. And they're enemies of faith. You understand? A little bit. Now, I'm not saying that you can't do that. What do you do? If the kid hadn't been passed through the fires of Molech, and if he didn't have the high places, he couldn't find his way across the street. So what do you do?
They're necessary for a time.
You find out that until the temple is dedicated, even Solomon worshipped at the high place.
Serveth the law?
Yeah. But what happened once the temple was fully dedicated, the high places had to be destroyed. Because the type is, until you are fully dedicated, until this temple is fully dedicated to God, if you don't have those high place worship activities, you will die. You can't find your way across the street. But once the temple is fully dedicated, the just shall live by his faith and that alone, not by a value system. That's why even the idea of cause and effect has to go. Okay. And he defied Topheth. Now, Topheth is in the valley of Hinnom. And Hinnom is the dump. I mean, what they're saying is this stuff was in the dump. Somebody's not okay. What's going on? You fine?
I'm a little confused about the green beans and the sugar. I mean, like you said, what do you do? You can't just let the kid eat them. But you answered, I think. I'm still hashing through.
Well, I mean,
it's good for
what
time.
Do you do? You do what you have to do, but it's still, if you can recognize that, still
right.
Passing your kids through a value system. You value right. The green beans more than the dessert. You know.
But you cause them to, you cause the child to value the dessert more than the green beans.
Right.
I mean, the opposite thing happens. Do you understand? That's mm-hmm. Okay.
But he's not saying you can fix it or.
And no,
that's what I was going to say. What do you do different? How do you fix it?
No, what do you say?
He's saying that you can't raise them without doing that.
Right.
And when do they get to that point? I mean, when do we get to that point?
When the temple is fully dedicated.
I mean, when is that?
You know.
I know exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. It's when you can take no thought for your own life. Mm-hmm. You can take no thought for tomorrow.
I mean, as a child, does that happen?
It doesn't as a child. It can't happen as a child. That's why a child can't be baptized. Because a child can't come to repentance. Child can only say, I'm sorry I did this.
When you make a mistake.
Say you're sorry.
You make a mistake. I'm sorry. We just did that last night.
I taught him how to do that.
Okay, but do you understand that when you make him say they're sorry, then you've just passed them through more fires.
Yeah. But sometimes if they recognize they've done something wrong with you, you know, then automatically they'll apologize, but it's our value system.
But then the next thing time they'll do, they'll find out they can get by with it. And so they'll say, I'm sorry, without meaning it, because they got them off the hook. And pretty soon you've raised a nation of con men and women. And he took away the horses that the kings of Judah had given to the sun. You understand that horses were illegal in Israel? Why? Because horses represented the armament, the power. And given to the sun at the entering into the house of the Lord by the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the chamberlain, which was in the suburbs, and burned the chariots of the sun with fire. And the altars that were on the top of the upper chamber of Ahaz, which kings of Judah had made, and the altars which Manasseh had made in the two courts of the house of the Lord, did the king beat down and break them down from thence, and cast the dust of them into the brook Kidron. And the high places that were before Jerusalem, which were on the right hand of the Mount of Corruption, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had builded for the Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Zidonians, and Chemos, the abomination of the Moabites, and for Milcom, the abomination of the children of Ammon, did the king defile. Now all of those, Ashtoreth, Chemos, and Milcom, were all gods that were worshipped in the high places by Solomon. You understand that? They were value systems, big-time value systems. Value systems as equally as important as family or respect or romance or any of the other idolatries that you exist by. These were the biggest ones. These three, Ashtoreth, Chemos, and Milcom, they represent the big three in you. Who are your big three idols? Now, they have to be smashed. They have to be ground to pieces, or you are of no value to God. You understand that? And he break in pieces the images and cut down the groves and filled their places with the bones of men. Now, I challenge you to, I remember the first time I started teaching on groves. I've never seen it taught anywhere. I mean, I've looked in every, but I mean, if you start looking and teaching, I mean, look, just looking at the meaning of the words and going into it, you can't miss its meaning. John Rutledge didn't believe that I knew what I was talking about. And so John took the Bible and went home with a concordance. And he could not believe the number of references to the groves. There were more references to the groves in the Bible than there were to the word salvation or saved. But your eyes are holden if you've never seen it.
Yeah. Not even the word.
And if you look in any English or any freshman language, Hebrew lexicon, you'll find that it doesn't mean trees, it's Ashtoreth. It's the goddess, it's the fertility goddess. Anyway. Before you came here, how many of you have ever studied the groves? Never heard of it.
It's funny though, when you read the Old Testament now, it seems it's all it's talking about. Yeah. You know, like high places and groves and stuff. So.
Now again, they had high places, not just in Jerusalem, but at different places. Throughout every place that the tabernacle in the wilderness was taken, which eventually each of these places became a city of refuge, there were high places in each of those, and there were altars. It says, moreover, the altar that was at Bethel, and the high place which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, had made, both the altar and the high place he brake down, and burned the high place, and stamped it to small powder, and burned the grove. And as Josiah turned himself, he spied the sepulchres that were there in the mount, and sent and took the bones out of the sepulchres, and burned them upon the altar, and polluted it, according to the word of the Lord which the man of God proclaimed, to proclaim these words. In other words, the search was without mercy. Throughout the land, to ensure that there was no high place activity in the land. Can you feel that from reading this?
Yeah.
And then he said, "What title is that I see?" And the men of the city told him, "It is the sepulcher of the man of God who came from Judah and proclaimed these things that thou hast done against the altar of Bethel." And he said, "Let him alone, let no man move his bones." Why? Why did they bring back Jacob's bones from Israel? I mean, from Egypt. Why did they carry his bones all the way back? Why here, when they saw and they recognized the man of God, and that was dead, that had spoken the word of God, why did they say, don't destroy his bones?
Because the bones are like the foundation of the office, and that's what...
Right. The bones are the bones represent the thing that they represent your office in the body of Christ. The flesh represents the counterfeit of it. All right. And he said, let him alone, let no man move his bones. So they let his bones alone with the bones of the prophet that came out of Samaria. And all the houses also of the high places that were in the cities of Samaria, where the kings of Israel had made to provoke the Lord to anger, Josiah took away and did to them according to all the acts that he had done in Bethel. And he slew all of the priests of the high places that were there upon the altars, and burned men's bones upon them, and returned to Jerusalem. And the king commanded all the people, saying, keep the Passover unto the Lord your God, as it is written in the book of this covenant. Now, do you understand? Can you hear this carefully? That Jesus Christ and every one of the disciples kept the Passover every year. That Paul and every one of the disciples kept the Passover every year for the first 100 years of the church. That we, because we are now keeping the feast, we would be considered the norm of Christian life. But in this society, it's the weirdness of Christian life because we keep the feasts. There's no thing that we do that is more fascinating to reporters than the fact that we keep the feasts. And yet not one of them has written well about it. I mean, you understand? There's no other... Hear me. How can I say this? We have no normative, no value system, no view of what a Christian life should look like, except this book. You understand that? We don't care what... I mean, again, as I've said, it's like it's quoted a lot lately, but unless it's 2,000 years old, I really don't care about it. Now, hear me and understand, I don't know. I mean, there are other sort of Jewish Christian groups that make a stab at doing some little Seder ceremony, like the Zola Levitt thing. But I don't know any other Christian group that keeps Passover like we do, where we go and do all of the things, the burning of the leaven, the high places. Hear me, if we are right, we are the most fortunate of all people on the face of the earth.
Amen.
Now, if we are not right, I want you to show me where we're not. I don't want you to silently rebel at something. If there's any part of this that you do not think should be done or that is not right. In other words, either be hot or cold. Don't be lukewarm. Produce your strong cause.
I like that saying that you talked about in the stationery, test all things.
Prove
all things.
Okay. And he said, keep the Passover unto the Lord your God, as it is written in the book of the covenant. This is one of my favorite scriptures ever. Surely there was not holden such a Passover from the days of the judges that judged Israel, nor in all the days of the kings of Israel, nor in the days of Judah, but in the 18th year of the king Josiah, wherein this Passover was holden to the Lord in Jerusalem. Reason the Passover was the greatest Passover of all time was because they prepared themselves by destruction of the high places. Now, why isn't this taught? Why?
Modern Christianity doesn't think it's necessary.
Like darkness. They look at it as a place, not as in you. They look at it as literal. Those high places and those priests, they're gone.
Because it goes hand in hand with the cross. I mean, it's like you can't do one of these things without the cross. I mean, you take it all or you don't take it at all. I mean, the cross is not preached.
You can't observe the feast and keep your little private life. It's not possible. It's too convenient.
Leave it to say, suffice it to say that it bothers me tremendously that You know, I don't want to start a denomination. I don't want us to grow any. In fact, I wish half of you would leave. But the problem is I don't know which half, so it never worked. I can never. I mean, my life was a whole lot simpler when there were 30 or 40 people in the total body. We have got to somehow make this information available to the body of Christ universal. It is not something that we can keep to ourselves. It is not something that if you believe it as passionately as I do, please pray that there will be a way that it's done.
You know, I struggle with that. Paul, it seems, went to the synagogues and just spoke.
It's because he was invited, because they had a forum. Let me tell you about synagogues.
Okay, but that's where I'm headed, the forum. Is there any place that there is a forum nowadays?
Let me tell you what we've tried.
Let's get a dish.
When I was in New York at this Media America meeting, the guys could not visualize what kind of program that I was talking about. And, you know, what would it look like? What would it appear to be? And I said, well, you may not understand what I'm about to say, but what the program would be just like the ancient synagogue. And the guy just went crazy. I mean, because I told you that his father has been studying with this group for 25 years. This kind of stuff. We've lost that. In ancient times, at the time of Paul, the synagogue was the place where if there was a visitor, he would be addressed and says, if you have anything to say, say on. And it says that the people of Berea, as an example, when Paul came there, he stood up to speak. When the local rabbi said, say on, he said on, and then the people of Berea, it was the only people that I've ever seen commended. It says that he commended the people because they searched the scriptures daily to see whether these things be true. And Paul stayed there daily. He didn't go and give it a one shot. Wasn't some lone ranger and passed out several bullets and left. He stayed there so that his doctrine would be tested. As far as I can tell, on his first trip, Paul never stayed. He always stayed at least a year and a half, most of the time 3 years. And so the idea of synagogue is the place where everything is tested. It's the opposite of what it is now, what church is now, or what mosque is now. You go there and you get fed instead of get challenged. Well, the idea of synagogue is the idea of challenging. There's no forum for that. So I would love... Again, I trust me, I do not. I mean, I think we could probably create a very big denomination fairly quickly. I do not want us to do that. So, Daniel 12. Remember, I've talked to you about the reason for doing hot seats in Zephaniah? Where it says, act as though the end were here now. See what it would be like if the end were here tonight. How would you respond? Remember? That's what a hot seat is. It's as though you were sitting on this. If it was all over, you were sitting on the judgment seat of God. Let's go to, with that in mind, go to Daniel 12. And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the people, the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame, and everlasting contempt. And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament. And they that turn away, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. Now, I want you, if the Lord delays his coming and you die in the natural, that when you stand up, that you will stand up to everlasting life and not to shame. The only way I know that can take place is by the efficacy of the resurrection of Jesus Christ in you. But the only way that I know it can be taken place to another degree is for you to face the shame today. And that's what we were going to be doing for the next few weeks, is trying to understand shame, to see how shame causes you, fundamentally, shame causes you to feel separate and to fear separation. That's its bottom line. And therefore, it causes you to act in a way that there is no faith. And it causes you to act in a way that you do not believe you have control over. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So that's what... Let's go to Isaiah 66. The biggest thing that happens when you feel shame is you feel immobilized and you feel silent. You know what I mean? Now, hear me. For some of you, shame has been your garment your entire life. And it's a dumb garment. It's moth-eaten, it's old, and it's worn. How do you know if shame is your garment? The main reason to know whether or not shame is your garment is whether or not you fear separation. Now, I want to get to a level that we've never got to before. Now, everybody's outward manifestation of shame, the effect of it, is somewhat different because it manifests in violence. Some it manifests in immobilization. You know, some it manifests itself in just, okay. It's a look. I mean, it's not silence, but it's a look, and it's a downturning of the mouth, and it's a talking, but a helplessness while you're talking. That's why we must get to the point where Christ was, where we can despise the shame. Shame. It has no socioeconomic it's an equal opportunity offender. It offends all socioeconomic classes, all peoples of all nations at all times. For some, shame becomes this motivator. It's the Zig Ziglar response to shame. For others, it's, you know, the Jackman response to shame. You end up in the street. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're successful in the world or not in the world. It has nothing to do with age. It has only to do with recognizing it as a purpose. It's the most difficult of all emotions to admit to, and it's the most difficult of all things to release. You can talk to someone till hell freezes over. I mean, there's no response. Whenever shame enters the picture, it inhibits free expression of emotion. The only emotion that is capable of being responded to or expressed freely is anger, deep, deep anger. Now, much of it begins in childhood, and that's what we'll try to address. It's the most private of all emotions. It's the only emotion for which there's no facial expression. The only thing that can happen is there's some kind of a turning away or hiding. It's the only objective sign of shame. Now, some people confuse guilt and shame, but they're two totally different things. I think the last time we talked about shame, many people got it confused with guilt. But guilt refers to feelings about an act, a transgression, real or imagined. It does not bring with it the self-loathing that shame does. Shame goes directly to one's basic sense of self. It's an experience, it's experienced as just total humiliation and loathing of self. I think the reason I've been hesitating here, I want to make sure that everyone agrees that we should do this. Is there anyone here that thinks that we're entering into somebody, something that's not our business, or it's...
I realized that last Thursday that when you were talking about, you know, facing your own sin, I've never done that. And I realized that I may have been in the theater where my sin was playing, but I was peeking around the corner. I had never had the courage to really look at it. So that's kind of an eye-opener for me. You know, as a Baptist, you never even had to go that far. All you had to say is, God, forgive me and save my soul, and I believe in your name. And all of that was like the big ticket. So all of this is kind of frightening to me. It is frightening. I mean, this God stuff is not as easy as it used to be.
I don't know. No, it isn't.
You're dead.
Well, that still didn't answer my question. Do you think you believe that it's necessary to go through this?
Yes. That doesn't mean that I want to, or I think that, I mean, I know I don't even have the littlest idea of how painful this will be, but yes, I think it's necessary.
When I, let me give you a small example. I don't know if I've talked about this before, but I can remember it. I was 10 years old, probably, something of that nature. And I was walking a friend. She was a girl, but she was not a girlfriend. She was just a friend. And I was walking her home through a particular part of the town, and these older guys, the big kids, came and began to taunt her and to taunt me. And I ran, left her to who knows what. And I had so buried that, because that doesn't fit, that doesn't go with my image of myself. You understand? My doctrine of creative consistency filtered that one way out. But when I remembered it, I mean, it was like an overpowering sense of shame. I just remembered that recently. But pathological shame comes when you have some minor failure or some minor offense or some such thing, and you have the same feeling for that as that dramatic transaction. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
What,
say it again.
There's a condition called pathological shame, and that's when you have that same exact feeling of total and complete that you've betrayed somebody, like I did, over somebody's glance at you, or over a misspoke word, or some small, small little thing, that your sense of shame is so overpowering that it comes on you over the littlest thing. Does that communicate? Do you understand me? Now, that's
doesn't have to be something like a betrayal. Or maybe
no, it can be a little teeny thing. It controls your response to how you respond to people. It controls how you respond to relationships. Over a small rebuke. I mean, if I close the Bible in front of him, he gets this overpowering sense of shame. Or if I toss my head, it's the overpowering sense of shame. I mean, it's slowly gone away, but for those of you that have been here, I mean, he's, and when he feels it, it's pathological, and he has to strike out and kill in order for it to. Now, there's some of you that are in this state. Some of you are more sophisticated. Psychologists say that shame begins to emerge in the second year of life. And what happens is the kid begins to realize that he or she is a separate person. The idea that, remember I've told you, we've talked before, that in China you're not considered a child, you're not considered a human being under their law until a child can smile when it's left alone. Now, you know, some of you wouldn't be considered human beings yet. But I mean, that's a kind of an interesting definition. It means that you've conjured up your magic as a child to such a degree that you can feel successful alone. That's a big deal. Have you ever watched these little kids? I mean, yeah. Now, it's also accomplished by understanding that others are sending emotional messages to you. And the kid begins to understand that. He begins to pick up on that others are sending messages to him. Now, it's interesting that pride and shame appear at the same time of your life. Pride at displeasing.
I just remembered something.
Yeah. Yeah, for a long time here, if people could accuse me of anything except saying what?
The other one is I won't even say the word, but it has to do with playing games.
Cheating.
I can say that.
No, that's good. Both of them would send me into a wildfire. If somebody accused me of cheating, or if somebody accused me of betraying them. Yeah. And I'm sure it had its root in that early shame. So anyway, that's why the interesting thing about these things, about in here, getting into the, every one of you have a hole in the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what you've tried to do up till now with that hole in the wall is you've dabbed mortar on it.
Untempered mortar.
You put untempered mortar in the wall.
Yeah.
Caulking it. What?
Caulking the wall. Oh, no.
And you need to be digging it out.
Toothpaste.
Okay.
I'll put this stick.
Let's go to Ezekiel 8. Ezekiel is a book about your high place activities. And the whole book. It's an internal view of. And that's why nobody understands Ezekiel, but it's really neat when you see it. And it came to pass in the sixth year, in the sixth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I sat in mine house, and the elders of Judah sat before me, that the hand of the Lord fell upon there, the hand of the Lord God fell there upon me. Okay. Then I beheld, and lo, a likeness as the appearance of fire, from the appearance of his loins even downward fire, and from the appearance of his loins even upward, as the appearance of brightness, as the color of amber. And he put forth the form of a hand, and took me by a lock of mine head, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven, and brought me in the vision of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looketh toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provoketh to jealousy. Now again, you got to understand, he didn't move anywhere. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there according to the vision that I saw in the plain. Then said he unto me, Son of man, lift up thine eyes now the way toward the north. So I lifted up mine eyes the way toward the north, and behold, northward at the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy in the entry. And he said furthermore unto me, Son of man, what seest thou what they do, even the great abominations that the house of Israel committeth here, that I should go far off from my sanctuary? But turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations. And he brought me to the door of the court. And when I looked, behold, now again, do you remember the door? He's talking about, first of all, the court of Gentiles. Okay? There's a wall around the court of Gentiles. And that's the farthest that the Gentiles can go in the temple. And when you see the court, when you see that the temple is measured, later on in Ezekiel, it says that you leave off the court of the Gentiles. So that's only from the court of women to the court of Israel to the court of priests that you see that's included. Now he's brought us to the court of Gentiles. And now there's a hole in the wall, and now we're going to look and see what it is. Now that's what happens in you. This can't even be seen. You can't even get to the wall until you understand. But the first thing you saw was that this image of jealousy was there, and it was right. That God was jealous over you with a godly jealousy, but you have gone on about your own way. But now, once you admit that, then you can get to this next stage, this next wall, the wall at the court of Israel. Okay? Now, there's a hole in the wall. And he brought me to the door of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. Then said he unto me, Son of man, dig now in the wall. And when I had digged in the wall, behold, a door. No one held in the door. The point is, if you don't, the reason that there was a hole, and when he dug, there was a door, was that all the time the door was there. But you didn't want to go in there because you intuited it would cost you everything. So all this time, your whole life, you've been covering over that door with untempered mortar. And the reason the hole was there is the reason that you even thought about this in the first place was a failure. There's a failure is the hole. Something about your life had failed, and there was a hole in the wall. And the hole was there, the door was always there that you could always go, because the door was Jesus Christ. He was the door that would take you from the court of the Gentiles to the holy place. I am the door. But you'd covered him over with your own ideas and opinions and what you wanted to do. And you got it? When I digged in the wall, behold a door, and he said unto me, Go in, and behold the wicked abominations that they do here. So that's, you're going in now. So I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping things and abominable beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed upon the wall round about. Now, all flesh is the same. From every culture, it's the same. When you go in there and look into this wall, it's the wall of your mind, you have written every abominable beast and creepy and crawly thing, and all of the images that you think things, the way you think things should be, and the things that give you life. It's the same in all men. This isn't just you, it's everybody.
This is the wall surrounding the court of Gentiles?
Right. And there stood before them 70 men of the ancients of the house of Israel. In the midst of them stood Jaazaniah, the son of Safan, with every man his censer in his hand, and a thick cloud of incense went up. Now, the 70 elders are, each of you have 70 elders at least here, and they're your counselors. They're still yapping. This is the way you should be. This is what you should do. And the idea that every one of them had the censer in his own hand, they all violated the law, because the censer could only be in the hand of the high priest. And any man that had the censer in his own hand, was killed. But these men, all of them who are your elders, who are your spokesmen, who are your court of law for you, they each have the censer in their own hands. So that means that none of them have the right to be there. But you have given them the right. You have puffed them up. You have given them life. You have put incense in their censer. Censer is your thoughts and their thoughts. See, hear me. There are no original thoughts. Nothing that you are thinking came from you. It all came from these men, these 70 men in you. You understand that? Can you possibly believe that? You're a hunk of, you're just a hunk of protoplasm that has chemical and electrical impulses. That thought it was special, that thought it was unique, that thought it had ideas and plans and wonders and greatness, and all of a sudden, wait a minute, something else is going on here. Well, now you got to fire these elders. You got to fire this your own Sanhedrin, because they're illegal. Each one has his own censor. And it's the same censor, the same thoughts that have been, all flesh is the same. You're not thinking anything new. You're not going through any unique little tests. All right. And a thick cloud of incense went up. Why? The incense that goes up is the prayers, but the prayers are your thoughts. So there's nothing that the thoughts are so muddled. Speaking of muddled, never mind. Then said he unto me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the ancients of the house of Israel do in the dark? Every man in the chambers of his own imagery. For they say, the Lord seeth us not. The Lord hath forsaken this earth. Therefore you have to take it on by your own devices. And that's what their power is. Now, read that more. But anyway, that's where we have to dig. We have to dig into that wall.
I have a question. When it says Son of Man, and he said unto me, Son of Man.
Son of Man is Jesus Christ. He's talking to Christ in you, the hope of glory. It's time for Christ to kick some ass. Clean his temple before the Passover. Get rid of all. Going to open up a can of whoop ass. Going to clean the temple of the money changers.
Okay, you answered
it. It's going to cleanse
it. It's easy to look past that.
Huh?
It was easy, to look past that. And then my eyes were like, wait a minute. Something.
That's good.
How do we do that? Is it? How do we cleanse it?
By opening it. First thing you do is, now, if you believe what he said, now you are clean by the word that I've spoken. You are already clean. You have to believe you are. You have to believe that there's no part of that earth where he's forsaken you. But that happens, as far as I know, the only way that happens is by confessing our fault one to another that we might be healed.
Are we going to have a ranch deal, or are we just
gonna... I don't know.
How do we know? I mean, how do we reach back? How do you...
Oh, we'll figure out a way.
We have way more.
You're sitting in the right seat to get a good start.
No, the skillful application, a nice keyboard to see, right?
Let me quickly read the rest of that. He said unto me, turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do. Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and there, behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. And that's the place that you weep, or you desire for something, some change in your life, some activity of the future. You're weeping for Tammuz. It's the resurrection God, rather than being content in the state you find yourself. Then he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations than these. And he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, at the door of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east. And they worshiped the sun toward the east. Now that's the places, those, the counselors in you that say it's going to get better when the sun rises tomorrow. That's where you've made a covenant with death and with hell, you're at agreement. Then he said unto me, hast thou seen this, O son of man? Is it a light thing to the house of Judah that they commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence and have returned to provoke me to anger. And lo, they put the branch to their nose. Therefore will I also deal in fury. Mine eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity. And though they cry in mine ears with a loud voice, yet will I not hear them. Anyway, then the next, in chapter 9, which you understand, like when Ezekiel was speaking and he was writing stuff, God didn't say, okay, let's make it chapter 9 here. Let's take a break. It's chapter 9 is the fruit of what we've just seen. So I'd encourage you to read it. The only people that are saved are the one with the towel, the mark on the forehead, and that's the cross. Amen? Amen. Take it, big guy.